A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books Podcast. I'm Claire Armistead.
And I'm Richard Lee.
Most people believe you're either racist or you're not. And if you're not, you're nice and good and open. And if you are, you're bad and mean and not open. And that definition actually beautifully protects the system of racism.
That was Robin DiAngelo, who we're about to hear from about her book, White Fragility. We'll also be talking to Margaret Busby, who's been dealing with these issues from the other side since the late 1960s when she became the UK's first black woman publisher, and whose thinking has just culminated in a magnificent anthology of writing by more than 200 daughters of Africa. But first, Robin DiAngelo, a sociologist and academic whose work has focused for 20 years on radically changing the dialogue around racism. Her latest book is nonetheless still putting the cat among the pigeons. Richard, the full title of the book is White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism. It has echoes of Reniero Lodge's book, doesn't it? Does this book actually solve anything?
I don't know if it solves anything. It's, as you say, it's got echoes of Reniero Lodge's book, but it's kind of told from the other side, as it were. I mean,
That was why I'm no longer talking to white people about race, for people who don't remember it.
Exactly. Yes, it's almost, as it were, kind of the flip side of Reniero Lodge's book, in some sense. It's written by a white woman talking to white people about why it's so difficult for them to talk about racism. And it's a rather uncomfortable experience to read, really, as a white man. But then again, in a country where black people are three times as likely as white people to be arrested, or more than half young people in jail are of BME origin, or people with a minority ethnic background have to send 80% more applications before they receive a positive response to a job application, it's a kind of uncomfortable situation. So it's right that we should be feeling some discomfort.
White fragility. Why did you choose that word, fragility? Because that implies somehow being vulnerable, when actually what you're talking, it's not about, it's vulnerable to our own prejudices, isn't it? It's not a normal configuration of that word.
Well, white fragility is the idea that white people react badly when racism comes up, or when a discussion of racist issues emerges, partly as a kind of strategy, not a conscious strategy, an unconscious strategy to change the subject, to move it on. And she, DiAngelo, argues that it's a kind of blurring between the society and the individual, and between the conscious and the unconscious, which is making this happen. Reminded very much of Daniel Kahneman's System 1, unconscious thinking, and System 2, conscious thinking. And she lays out the idea that prejudice is something that everybody has, because we all make unconscious judgments, and being brought up in a racist society, those unconscious judgments are necessarily informed by the racist attitudes around us. And then she makes the distinction between that and discrimination, which is acting on those prejudices, and then racism, which is a structural thing about the way that society is put together, and which puts white people in a position of power which is impossible to avoid. And so the accusation of racism shouldn't be at all surprising to people who are white. It's just part of the fact of the way we've been brought up and the society that we live in. But when these accusations are made, she's been training people in racial justice and consulting about racial issues for more than 20 years. And when in the sessions, when these accusations are made, people react with anger or denial. They try and shut it down and say that it's because it's as if they're being accused of being a bad person. But it's not that the idea that somebody has said something which is racially problematic makes them a bad person as such. It's that this is part of the society in which they live. So when she joined me in the studio, I began, as bluntly as she does in her book, actually, by asking her if, me being a white man living in the UK, if she was calling me a racist.
I am saying that you've been socialized into a racist system and that you necessarily, as a result, have a racist worldview.
So I'm taking that as a yes.
Well, notice how I dodged. Because I also know my people, and it's not strategic to come out of the gate saying, yes, you're a racist, because people will, white fragility will ensue, and we won't get any further. So
yeah, it's not because I've done something terrible on the way up to the studio or because I've said something wrong or off. It's much broader than that. So maybe we should start by laying out the difference between prejudice and discrimination and racism.
And maybe in some ways gender is a really easy way in. I mean, necessarily the moment your gender assignment was male, you were socialized in a particular way. I don't think anybody would deny that you being raised as a boy, you got different messages. You have a different trajectory than I have. And there are parts of that that you might want to change or challenge, right? And it's really similar with being raised as a white person, right? So prejudice, prejudgment, all human beings have socially learned prejudgments about other social groups as defined in a given culture. I mean, everybody has prejudice. There's no human objectivity.
Yeah, and you say learn, but it's much deeper than explicitly taught, isn't it? It's kind of unconscious as well.
Yeah. I mean, we absorb, in the same way that being raised as a boy, I'm going to keep going back to that because it's so easy and accessible. There are things you were explicitly taught and then things nobody had to say, but you absorbed, right? Discrimination, of course, is when we act on our prejudice. Everybody does discriminate, mostly in very subtle ways, of course, not to the recipient of it, but certainly to the perpetrator. All human beings have prejudice and all human beings act on that more often unconscious or what we call implicit bias. Right. And the research in implicit bias is really helpful for people who do what I do, because, again, you don't have to be aware of your thoughts and actions in order to engage in them. When you back a group's collective bias with legal authority and institutional control, it is transformed. It is transformed into a far-reaching system, and it becomes the default of the society because it's infused in everything.
Because backed up with power.
Exactly. And so I reserve that term, racism, to acknowledge that really profound difference. Yeah.
Yeah, as David Wellman said, it's a system of advantage based on race.
Yes.
Which we as white people are kind of necessarily enmeshed in.
Yes.
I guess the power of the unconscious in this, I think, is something that is really interesting. I'm wondering what the role the unconscious plays in this, because, I mean, it's something that, for example, Daniel Kahneman has argued that there's different ways of thinking.
Right.
And that one is actually much more powerful than we often give it credit for.
Yeah, actually, our unconscious biases are we can think about them as more powerful in that they drive our behaviors, but they're not necessarily known to us immediately. Most people, and certainly most white people, think racism must be conscious and intentional in order to have occurred. And if it isn't conscious or intentional, it can't be racism. There's a term sociologists use for different types of racism, but one is aversive. And that is the one people like you and I, I'm going to assume you're a nice liberal white progressive like I am.
I work for The Guardian.
Yeah, exactly. We're most likely to have aversive racism because what we've internalized at the unconscious level conflicts with our professed beliefs. And we're actually more likely to protect that bias and resist challenges to it because, again, it interferes with the way we see ourselves in the world.
I guess if all white people are racist, doesn't that rob the term of any kind of explanatory power?
No, I think when you take people of color out of the equation, it has a lot of power to say that all white people are racist. That is very provocative. Right now, it is used in a way that either includes everybody or includes nobody. Do you ever wonder what qualifies as racism in the white mind? It would seem nothing does, or that to be a good person and to be complicit with racism are mutually exclusive.
It's almost as if it's kind of a divide into good and bad, isn't it?
Absolutely, the good-bad binary. Most people believe you're either racist or you're not. And if you're not, you're nice and good and open. And if you are, you're bad and mean and not open. And that definition actually beautifully protects the system of racism. And I think it's the root of virtually all white defensiveness on this topic. Because if that's what I think it means to be racist, and you suggest that anything I've said or done is racially problematic, I'm actually going to hear that as a question to my very moral character.
It's an attack, isn't it?
Oh, and now I need to defend my moral character, and I will. And, you know, round and round and round we go. You must have misunderstood me because I couldn't have said or done anything racist because I'm not racist, and on and on and on we go. It's actually incredibly liberating to start from the premise that, of course, you've internalized racist thoughts and assumptions and worldviews. And so you can stop defending, deflecting, denying, and actually just get to work trying to figure out, okay, so how is that manifesting in my life and my relationships?
Yeah, and how can I shift my space along that continuum?
Right. And honestly, refusal to engage is not going to do that.
You've been training people about racial justice for more than 20 years now. What kind of reactions do you get when you point out behavior that is racially problematic in that kind of setting?
Almost invariably, white fragility. Right. So when I coined that term, the fragility was meant to capture how little it takes to upset white people around race. So for many of us, the mere suggestion that being white has meaning will upset us. Probably even more so will be generalizing about white people. I cannot tell you the emails I get. You know, you're generalizing about white people and that's racist. If I may, so just to preempt some of those. Do you think I've never heard that before? And do you think that I think it's racist? And therefore, I mean, ask yourself, here's someone who's committed to challenging racism. Why don't I ask why she does that rather than insist that she must not realize what she's doing?
Because one of the privileges of whiteness is the idea that it's in no way special, that it's neutral.
Absolutely. We are the norm for humanity. I am just a person. Toni Morrison is a particular kind of person. And when we're talking about that, we'll go to Toni Morrison. But when we're talking about the universal human experience, we'll go to, I don't know, Shakespeare or Hemingway or something. We are unique individuals, of course. And I do not know the story of every one of your listeners. But we are also members of a social group by which we could literally predict whether you and your mother were going to survive your birth. And we can predict how long you're going to live because you're a member of this social group. We have to be willing to grapple with the shared collective experience of being white, because there is a shared collective experience. There are messages that every one of us gets, regardless of our individual desires or intentions, right? In the same way that I would want you to grapple with the collective socialization you got as a boy. You individually had a response to it, but you got it. I'm just asking white people to grapple with how we've been shaped by being members of this group. And the insistence that we were not shaped by it is really holding racial inequality in place.
So when you say to somebody, there's a problem with what you've just said, what's the response you get?
I didn't mean it, but you need to know this. But it's a knee-jerk, instantaneous deflection for whatever reason. And if we go underneath and look at what is driving that response, well, then it reveals kind of the paradigm we're operating from. And we keep coming back to only mean people who intended racism could ever be racist or do anything racist. And I'm not mean and I didn't intend it. So now I'm going to need to fight you and your suggestion of anything different.
And that's even despite the fact that this is occurring in a setting where the whole point of the training is to work out if there's problems with race.
Oh, absolutely. No, it's fine on an abstract level. If we get real in the room, or we talk about individual person's actual engagement, that takes us to another level. You know, I was once giving a training, a mixed race group. I asked a question to the people of color in the room. How often have you given white people or a white person feedback on our inevitable and often unaware racist patterns? And had that go well for you? And they laugh and they roll their eyes and, you know, never, rarely. That's something worth noticing, right? I think the worst fear of a white progressive is that we would accidentally say something racist. But then how do we respond when you let us know we indeed accidentally did something racist? How dare you, right? So I followed up my question in that room with, well, what would it be like if you could just tell us when we revealed this conditioning and had us receive that feedback with grace, reflect on it, and seek to change our behavior. And I'll never forget this man of color raising his hand and saying, it would be revolutionary. And just hold that for a minute, revolutionary, that we would receive the feedback with grace, reflect, and seek to change our behavior. That's how difficult we are. But it's also how easy it is. We simply cannot get there from that current paradigm.
So when did this idea that to be racist meant you were a bad person, where did it arise?
Well, it's probably been around for a while, but it seems to me that post-civil rights, it was probably the most brilliant adaptation of the system of racism to the challenges of the civil rights movement, you know, at least in the U.S. context. Post-civil rights, it became bad to be racist, right? Those were people we saw on TV that wouldn't let people sit on a bus and that were beating people at lunch counters and had hoods on. In the South, of course, those were racist.
Somebody else.
Right. And that was bad, right? And so to not be racist was to be good. And that functioned, of course, beautifully to hold everything in place.
And so when white people get defensive when you point out something they've done is racially problematic, what's the effect of that? What does that do?
I actually believe it functions as a kind of bullying. A kind of everyday white racial bullying, because we do make it so difficult for people of color to talk to us.
Just shuts down the conversation.
That most of the time they actually don't bother. Just trust me, people of color working and living in overwhelmingly white spaces take home way more of our daily slights and indignities than they bother talking to us about, because they tend to risk more punishment. It tends to get worse for them. And then before you know it, they're troublemakers and they have personal problems and they don't last, right? So they rarely have the experience of us receiving that with humility.
So if all white people are racist, if we're all enmeshed in the system, should we all be feeling guilt?
Oh, please no. Guilt is not useful. And if you're listening to me, it should be obvious I don't struggle with guilt. The moments I do feel guilty is when I haven't aligned what I profess to believe with my actual behavior. Let me be really clear. Niceness is not anti-racism. Smiling at people of color and being friendly and having friends is not ending racism, right? It's not, that is not changing our policies and our practices. It takes intentional action and interruption, right? But guilt tends to immobilize. We're not very effective when we're guilty. We're not in good shape. To be really honest, it tends to just be indulging in kind of self whatever. No, it's a natural part of the process of coming to consciousness about how we've been shaped. Just don't get stuck there.
Yeah, I guess if we are all a product of our upbringing, or what happened to us.
I didn't choose it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't choose this, and I don't want this. I got this, right? And so now I can get to work challenging it. But getting caught up in whether I'm a good or bad person is just not useful or productive, and it's not what I'm asking for.
I guess the distinction is to be made between guilt and responsibility.
Yeah, absolutely. What do we tend to feel guilty about when we haven't done the right thing? So a great antidote to that is action.
So I guess the question is, what do we do from here?
So that is the number one question that I get, right? And I want to challenge that question a little bit, and then I will offer something. If any white person listening right now has the question, what do I do? I want to ask a question back to you, which is, how have you managed to be a full functioning adult and not know? It's 2019. Why don't you know what to do about racism when people of color have been telling us forever? And that is meant to be a challenge, because I actually don't think for a lot of white people that it's a genuine question. I really don't. I don't think most white people are going to do anything different than continue being friendly, because it does take some investment. So having said that...
You mean it's a way of kind of abdicating that responsibility, sure. A way of sort of saying...
Oh, and it also functions as a way to dismiss what I'm saying because I didn't tell you what to do. Therefore, you don't have to engage. So take out a piece of paper and write down why you don't know what to do about racism. And you will have your map. And nothing on it will be easy or simple. It will be ongoing and lifelong, but there it will be. The first thing will probably be, I wasn't educated on this. Okay, great. Read Rennie Ito Lodge's book, among others. Two, I don't talk about racism. Oh, which I would say, I would put it like this. You don't break with white solidarity. Start breaking with white solidarity. That'll put you up against everything within yourself and other white people. You don't have people of color in your life, or if you do, you don't talk about these things. Notice that everything on that list will guide you to what to do, but it won't be easy, and it won't be comfortable either. We're not going to get there from a place of white comfort.
You say that the answers are obvious as soon as you stop to think, that the answers have been told to us for many years. But I'm wondering what's changed over the last 20 years of your guiding these sessions in.
Well, in the U.S. context, we are done with the Obama post-racial narrative.
That's been exploded.
Oh, boy.
It's gone out the window.
Nobody in the U.S. anymore would say we are post-racial, so that makes it easier.
But because there's a problem. You can see the problem right there in front of you.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. It's very explicit. I think this also puts the light on this idea that we're in some kind of arc of progress. I think anyone looking at what's going on in the U.S. and the U.K., it's more circular than that. I do function in a atmosphere in which there's more permission to be hostile across race, in which there are more threats of violence. And so it's a little scarier in that way. But for people who would never, of course, threaten violence, I notice more receptivity. I think by kind of ripping away that thin veneer of post-racialism has kind of shocked a lot of white progressives. And there's a kind of urgency, like, help me. Something's going on, and I need help. And so more receptive.
Have you found your sessions being met with increased danger of violence to yourself?
I have received death threats, and I get very ugly emails. I get more beautiful emails, emails that say, you really have changed the way I've thought about these things, or from people of color who say, I finally feel validated. Unfortunately, I've been saying this forever and not listened to, and this is the other power of whiteness, right? But I have had to have security guards on occasion. We're in that moment.
At public events?
Yes.
Yeah. I guess from what you were saying earlier, it sounds like this analysis applies very straightforwardly to issues of gender and class.
The key is to use your understanding of gender and class, if you have one. And let's face it, you don't automatically have one any more than you have one on what it means to be white if you haven't done some reflection. I mean, you're a man. I don't assume you've done deep thinking about your socialization under patriarchy. But if you have, it's a really good way in. So for me as a woman, and I grew up in poverty, so from a very early age, I had an acute sense of the pain of classism. That's been really useful to draw from. The key is not to use it to exempt yourselves. And many white people who are working class or grew up poor or women use that to exempt themselves. I couldn't possibly have privilege. I have suffered. I am not saying white people don't suffer or face barriers. You have not faced that one. That one's huge. And that one has helped you navigate whatever other barriers you face. The real oppression is class kind of narrative. I don't know anyone who could look me in the eye and say to be poor and black and to be poor and white is the same experience. Come on.
Yeah, it just doesn't add up, does it?
No, it doesn't.
But I mean, as usual, it's the people with power who need to fix the problem.
I believe that racism is a white problem. That does not mean that people of color don't collude or play a part in the same way that I play a part in sexism. But those who control the institutions have a particular kind of power, and we need to look at it and use it in much more transformative ways.
Robin DiAngelo there. She's really not letting us off the hook, is she, Richard?
No, not at all. No, I mean, as she says, people from minority ethnic backgrounds have been telling white people that there's a problem for years. It's not that the problem isn't that we have racist impulses. That happens because we've grown up in a racist society. The problem is if you're not taking concrete action to address their effects. So we need to actually stand up and do that.
Well, thanks to Robin. White Fragility is published by Penguin in the UK and Beacon Press in the US. We'll be back after the break to talk with Margaret Busby about a project which takes a radically different approach to the responsibilities of representation, making an argument for a lineage, a sisterhood, if you like, of Daughters of Africa, straddling continents and stretching back three centuries.
Hi, I'm Will Dean, editor of The Guardian Weekly. Since you're a Guardian Books listener, there's a good chance you'll love The Guardian Weekly. It's The Guardian's essential weekly news magazine, featuring a carefully curated selection of Guardian and Observer journalism to give you a global perspective on the issues that matter. You'll find leading opinion writing, analysis, long reads, and cultural coverage from around the world with free worldwide delivery. So, if you think globally, now's the perfect time to start reading weekly. Visit gu.com/books GW.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
In the late 1960s, when she was still in her very early 20s, Margaret Busby co-founded Alison & Busby, becoming the UK's first black female publisher, also probably the youngest ever to set up a company, male or female. Though she's too modest to say so, it's one of many of what she calls glorious firsts achieved by black women. She achieved another in 1992 with the publication of Daughters of Africa, a landmark anthology of writing by women she defines as being of African descent. Now she's on to her glorious second with the publication of New Daughters of Africa. And a good few of the astonishing 200 contributors weren't even alive when the first volume came out. She's joining Richard and me in the studio to discuss the issues it raises. But first, Margaret, a cheeky question. What do you think of the idea of white fragility?
I was glad to hear a bit of the interview just now, and I recognised a lot of what Robin was saying, and it actually was a relief to hear it being said, because quite often, I think she actually said that she'd spoken to black people who had those responses, they hadn't actually spoken them out aloud. And I think, as well, there are things that I would say to my black friend that we recognise because we don't have to translate things to each other, that I wouldn't say to a white friend because I wouldn't want to offend them, or I would know they would get defensive because they're not bad people. So that's a relief to hear it coming from somebody who themselves is white.
So I'm going to now quickly move on to the book, New Daughters of Africa, which I have to say is totally covetable. It's one of those books that I have this image of that I have intellectual salivary glands, which and my intellectual salivary glands have been going ever since I managed to get my hands on this massive book. It's more than 200 pieces from loads of the writers I'd never heard of. You've organised it in a really interesting way. So it's organised, it's structured around decade of birth.
Chronologically by decade of birth. That's
and you don't have any of the Daughters of Africa from the first volume in it, but you have some of their daughters, which
made me feel
terribly emotional.
I mean, I love those connections. I love the fact that it's not only the daughters of the people who were in the first volume, but actually in this volume we have a mother and daughter.
So you have Sadie Smith
and Yvonne Bailey Smith.
So, and you have Alice Walker's daughter Rebecca Alice Walker having been in the first
and we have Attila Springer, whose mother, Antu Pearl Springer, was in the first one. We have Nar Dove, whose aunt, Mabel Dove Danko, was in the first one. There are all these wonderful
connections. And Ngugi Wathiyongo's daughter.
Exactly.
So how wonderful is that? And it's hugely diverse in its forms. So you've got speeches, journalism, quite a lot of poetry. Extracts from some already published works, for example, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's work on feminism, and short stories.
It's got just about every genre you can think of is represented. In fact, one of the ways I put it to the writers I approached, the potential contributors, was how would you like to see yourself represented? So it was interesting that, for example, we have some poetry by Nadifa Muhammad, who you think of as a novelist. And also we have a piece by Ella Wakatama Olfi, who you think of as a publisher or an editor. So it was lovely to have those sort of surprises that happened when people sent in their contributions.
And I used to meet you when this was in formation, and you used to come up in a really worried way at publishing parties and say, do you know any African writers that I should know about? So how did you create these networks? Because it's sort of such a massive project. I am in awe of you for having tracked down all these people. I mean, they're in America, they are in Africa, they're in the UK, they're everywhere.
Every potentially every country could have had a contributor. And I suppose I had to start from what I know, what people had told me, who I had access to. I had a spreadsheet that had hundreds of names on it. And in fact, every time I would write to somebody, I mean, whether it's Zadie Smith or somebody, they'd say, oh, have you thought of so-and-so? So I was forever sort of broadening my horizons. There were just so many people who could have been in it, who should be in it, and I really want to do another volume now, because I mean, I'm not satisfied. I mean, I know this has only just come out, but I keep thinking, oh, why didn't I get that person in? I must have got the wrong email for her or whatever, or what, you know, somebody who said they'd been in it that didn't have time to deliver on, you know. So there are lots of reasons I want to do another volume, but I have to be satisfied. This is a big volume full of wonderful people. I mean, you say 200 living writers and some who are no longer living, because I wanted to make sure that it didn't seem as if we just started writing as African women or women of African descent in the sort of 1990s or, you know, in the 20th century. So it goes back to the 19th century with some writers.
To the 18th century.
Or to the 18th century.
Late,
yes.
Very. I mean, it is almost the 19th century.
Well, I wanted to make it clear that this isn't a new phenomenon, that African women, women of African descent, have been writing going back centuries. Mm. And that's why I wanted to start. It's not as if the ones I have included in this volume are the only ones who could have been from that earlier period. I just wanted to make it clear that there were writers writing in that early period who have influenced people, who are writing in completely different circumstances. And it's their legacy that enabled the younger writers. And we go out to people born in the 1990s who would not have been able to do what they're doing now had not all these other writers gone ahead.
So we talked about how you've organised it by decade, which is one of the structural principles. But then you also have themes. So, for example, migration. Inevitably, you have quite a few pieces addressing that. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, those themes emerged from what the writers, the contributors themselves, wanted to send in. So I didn't specify any themes. There are a lot of themes. For example, that whole Windrush generation theme of coming to Britain from the Caribbean, that occurs in different ways in different pieces that the writers have sent in. They may be poetry, memoirs, or novel extracts or stories, but they reference that journey from the Caribbean to Britain or even to the States in different ways. So that those were themes that kind of emerged naturally. I didn't actually go looking for them. I mean, in the same way as that, another theme that comes up in different ways is that theme of identity or self-identity or naming, claiming your name, claiming what you want to look like. There are different aspects of those themes that came out in different ways from all the contributors.
Some of the contributors, for example, one obvious thing is some of them are mixed race.
Yep.
Part of their heritage is that they're exactly, daughters of Africa.
I mean, there are some people who come from a lot of different places. I mean, I wouldn't want to pigeonhole anybody and say this person comes from Nigeria. I mean, some people, it's as in my case, I mean, I was born in Ghana, but actually I have family in Dominica, Barbados, Trinidad, you know, all over the place. And similarly, there are writers who are in here who are of Nigerian and Welsh heritage or whatever. And they all reference different parts. And there are writers here from, I don't know, Uganda who are writing about Guyana. So there's lots of crossover and lots of connections and references that they make to each other's work and to the work of previous generations.
That it almost adds up to some sort of a sort of portrait of that experience.
I think so. You're right. Yes. Yeah. It's. I mean, I every time I look at it, I reread some of the pieces, and it makes me feel very emotional because there are so many things that I connect with, as well as the writers connect with each other in different ways. And it's. I mean, for example, there's a Guyanese writer in here called Anne Dai, and she talks about having been living with cancer, and she talked about how Audre Lorde, who also had cancer and died, reached out to her and how she helped her through the issues that she was dealing with. And there are stories like that that are actually really revealing, and it's hard not to be moved when you read them.
Audre Lorde emerges as one of the heroines, doesn't she?
She was
such a generous spirit.
Yes,
she supported other women. But there are, I mean, everybody will take different things from it. And one of the things that I found most haunting was Beatrice Lamwaka's Missing Letter of the Alphabet, which is about female circumcision. Yeah. It's a short story. And her husband leaves her on her wedding night because he finds out that she has had, she's been mutilated. And she says, "We were the alphabet and the C was missing." And it made me cry.
Yeah, there are, the writers in the book deal with lots of difficult themes, I guess one would have to call them. And It's hard not to empathise with what some of the women are going through or have gone through, whether they're actually memoirs or fictionalised stories. So it's one of those books that you don't know what you're going to find as you turn the page.
So now, just to change the subject a little bit, I'd love you to read a bit from a poet who I am very, very keen on called Jay Bernard. And this is one of the radical inclusions for various reasons. But it also addresses one of the themes we would like to discuss with you a bit. Have things got better?
This is an extract from Jay Bernard's piece. "I used to be a bit of a psychogeographer. All criticisms considered, I used to like the term, the ideas, and made a zine for a short time called Psychogeography for the Modern Black Woman. I equated my gender with the city around me. I was not simply a woman, but a specific knot of places, perceptions, possibilities. It detailed my walks around London and mentioned the bookshops, squats, and other spaces I used to go to. Silver Moon, Index, Kennington Books, New Beacon, locations that made me make sense. Only one of those, New Beacon, still exists. Isn't that just what happens? Things disappear."
So that's a melancholy note for a young writer to be striking at a time in which, Richard, you've been doing lots of research into all the new initiatives that are happening that are supposed to be making the landscape a better place.
Well, as Robin DiAngelo suggests for us as individuals, as white people as individuals, that there are ways that we can address the racism in our daily lives that are obvious and we just need to take concrete steps now. It seems as if the books industry has reached a similar point where it's obvious that something needs to be done and people are beginning to take concrete steps. Do you think we've reached a point where people are beginning to drive change?
I sigh because it's a conversation that's been going on for so long. I remember in the 1980s I was part of a voluntary group called GAP, which stood for Greater Access to Publishing, and we were campaigning for more diversity in the publishing industry. And here we are in the 2019s, and the same conversation is happening and people are still talking about diversity and inclusivity and having projects and initiatives to make the industry more diverse. In a way, that kind of connects with what Robin DiAngelo was saying, because those initiatives that we keep hearing about are actually just shedding light on how good these people are who may have putting out the initiatives. And, okay, so you may get more BAME, I hate that term, writers published, but how is the industry changing? I can probably name you the majority of those people who are black, for example, in the industry on one hand, two hands. Why are there so few?
The Publishers Association survey revealed in January that only 11.6% of respondents in the publishing industry use that term. You abhor so much BAME as to describe yourself as BAME, whereas, I mean, which is far below the UK population, let alone the population of London, which is 40%.
Yeah.
So you're right, where are they?
And it's not only that, but when you might get one within a company, but then the pressure on that person is enormous. I mean, I have for various friends or people who've become friends, black women working in industry fulfilled the function of, they phone me up and I listen to them, tell me what's gone happening in the firm around them. It's all connected with their being the only BAME person in the industry. Like they're going to have a meeting on diversity and they get called in because they are the diverse person. And you know, why should it be so noticeable that there are so few? I mean, even coming into The Guardian sometimes I feel a bit worried because I feel, well, you know, maybe people will think I don't belong here. I mean, the people who know me, like you, the guys, all right, you're friends, but the security people, I'm just some stray black person wandering into the building. And you get responses based on the fact that you don't look as if you belong there.
I'm interested in this unease around the word BAME, which is black and minority ethnic for people who don't know it, because it's an attempt to, in a way, it's a sort of euphemism, isn't it? But it's a euphemism that's got people, it's awkward because it somehow contains an anxiousness in the fact that it's a sort of loose grouping of everything that isn't the majority, and yet it is a majority, really.
Yeah, well, it makes it easier to tick that box, you know, we've got a BAME person. And that whole debate about inclusivity and diversity doesn't only refer to BAME people, because, I mean, working class, disabled, and it's almost as if sometimes it seems as if there's a fashion, okay, we'll do BAME this month or this year and we'll do something else next year. And it shouldn't be like that. I mean, I don't want to go to a party where I'm always going to be the only person like me. But I'm not responsible for the invitations of that party, so I can't do anything about it. So the people giving the party who have to say, well, how diverse is our invitation list, if you like.
Mm. Richard, some of those publishing initiatives have been going for a while now, haven't they? For example, the Good Agency, which Nikesh Shukla set up, and also Right Now.
Yes, the reason why, I mean, it's just that it seems recent to us, but it seemed to me that Nikesh Shukla's The Good Literary Agency, he set it up in 2017 with an Arts Council grant. That seemed like to have an agency that was going out and looking for diverse voices seemed like a new step. The Right Now initiative, which Penguin Random House launched in 2016, has now helped 450 writers at regional workshops and has given 33 writers mentoring for a year. And you're beginning to get authors like Elizabeth Jane Burnett, who's going to be on the podcast later this year.
Is she in here? No, because she's emerged after. Yeah. She's only just emerging now.
There are lots of people who aren't in there. It doesn't mean that they're not worthy of being in here. They just happened to, I had to stop somewhere. But I think also there are a lot of publishers. Well, you know, there are good publishers who are doing the right thing without making a song and dance about it. There are people like One World or Canongate. They don't have to have special initiatives. And people like, you know, Nikesh and there are people who are BAME. They don't need to be the ones saying, I've got an initiative, because they are the initiative.
They just get on with it.
I think it's somehow complicating it a bit if everybody has to announce some special initiative. I think the point is to do something, and whether or not you get glory for doing that is not the point. To make the changes happen, you can do it without having a light shone on you to say, look how good I am, I'm doing this. But
there's another point about that, isn't it? It's about the structures of the institutions.
Yes.
In whatever country, in this case, the UK. So the structures of the institutions are that in order to get the money to encourage and stimulate a sector, you have to have an initiative.
Well, therefore, it's not even sometimes about encouraging and stimulating the sector. The sector is there. It's about how you access it, how you find it. I mean, 200 living women of African descent in this anthology, they are there. They could have been 500. It's whether or not you give them the opportunity to come through, whether or not you go looking in the right places for them. It's not that they don't exist. And it's also about letting them be who they are. Because I think one of the things that sometimes happens is people have an initiative and they will take on board people as trainees or interns in order to train them to be like themselves.
I think this is such an important point. I actually did an anthology of writing on London last year, and I, like you, have ended up with quite a lot of poetry in it. And the thing is, people tend to say they don't like poetry, it never sells, people don't read it. But in order to let people be who they are, if that's where they are, you have to let them do it. And it's one of the things I loved about this anthology.
Mm. Well, I mean, you know exactly what I'm talking about because you've done that anthology yourself.
A tiny little anthology compared to this.
But it comes from your mindset. I mean, you have to start with an open mind and not assume. I mean, one of the things that often happens is that booksellers or people assume that black people don't buy books or black people don't read books. And so, you know, we're having an event at the South Bank. We'll only have 30 copies. you're going to sell out because people, this happened with this anthology we're talking about. People buy it in twos and threes to give us presents because they're starved of things that actually they can connect with. So it's really the opposite, that Black people buy books if the books that they want to buy are available.
This is one of the things that the Cooperative Children's Book Centre in the US has revealed, a set of figures, which has showed a massive rise recently in the number of children's books published in the US from diverse authors and about diverse people. It's doubled in the last 10 years from an admittedly terrible level to something which is beginning to achieve some sort of respectability.
And it's reflected in the Carnegie shortlist, isn't it? The Carnegie Prize.
Yes, absolutely. The Carnegie Medal, there was a row in 2017 about the fact that they'd never awarded a Carnegie Medal to an author of colour.
And they had a long list without one single author of colour on it.
Yeah, exactly. and so they commissioned a report and have changed the awareness. I mean, the librarians who make the selections are predominantly, overwhelmingly white. And so they try to change that mindset. And this year the shortlists were announced last week, and there are many more people of colour there.
But I think there's also a strange notion that white people don't buy books by Black people. Or that if you have a... I mean, I grew up buying children's, you know, reading children's books that featured Snow White and white pictures. No Black people. So if I could, and most of my peers and people who come after me, they're used to children's books that have no connection with their own lives. So why suddenly, when... You know, you're getting some Black publishers like Tamarind Books, Bernard Wilkins, or people who are making it apparent that it's necessary for Black children to have images of themselves in books. Why should white children not also enjoy those books?
And that's something that the CCBC director cited about the increase, is that it's been driven by commercial success. I mean, titles like Angie Thomas's The Hate U Give, they're just tremendous bestsellers. And so publishers need to be realising that.
Yeah, I think one has to start from the people making the decisions about what to publish, what to stock in the bookshops. They had to be open enough to think, well, we've done things like this in the past, but that doesn't mean we have to always do things in the same way. Let's look at doing things in a different way. Let's be open to being schooled in how to do things differently. So I think that's part of the problem, that it's not always the fact that those traditional gatekeepers are the ones who know how best to do things. Sometimes they do things because that's how they've always done things.
And just before we wrap up, I mean, there's one interesting thing that comes out of the Carnegie list, which relates very much to the Daughters of Africa, New Daughters of Africa project, which is that these writers, a lot of them are writing verse novels. So the sort of link between verse and people who have been excluded from a lot of the time from conventional, you know, the media, as it were, mediaized conversation, is coming up in all sorts of different ways.
No, you're right. And the other thing that I find reading some of these contributors, New Daughters, they're writing things, they're spurred to write because they couldn't find what they wanted to read. So they're writing books, they're writing about topics that are not explored in any other things that they could find. So it's a bit like what Alice Walker said, or Toni Morrison have said in the past. They're writing the books they would have liked to read. I did the anthology I would have liked to see exist. So if it's not there, let's create it.
Margaret, thank you so much for coming in. We could go on talking all day. We probably will go on talking all day. I will certainly go on reading for many, many years.
Thank you.
New Daughters of Africa is published by Myriad Editions. In next week's podcast, Nina Stibbe will bring us all her reasons to be cheerful with the most recent of Lizzie Fogel's adventures.
And as always, do contact us on Twitter at Guardian Books or by leaving a comment on the podcast page. And also subscribe and review us wherever you get your podcasts.
But for now, from me, Claire Armistead.
And me, Richard Lee.
And our producer, Susanna Trezillian. Thanks for listening and goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Before Shopify, were you wondering, where are my sales at? Now you're selling with Shopify, the global commerce platform supercharging your selling. You have no problem selling online, in person, on social media, and beyond. Gary, easy on the cha-ching.
Oh, sorry, but my Shopify sales are through the roof.
Start selling with Shopify today and discover how millions of businesses around the world use Shopify to ignite their selling. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/listen. Shopify.com/listen.